Yes. It's a Bigler's World, right here on Sun Sounds, ba-ba-bum-bum, of Arizona. This is Jim Bigler for Bigler's World. I will be reading, what do I got here? Some National Geographic Kids magazine. I'm looking at a lot of stuff. We got science news, maybe do some Ranger Rick. I don't know. Let's start with Dogo news for kids. Stargazers to get a rare chance to witness a nova explosion. Bum, bum. So Maya Kolaru wrote this article here. Here is some exciting news for those who missed the solar eclipse on April 8th of 2024. Between now and September, NASA predicts an even rarer celestial event, a nova outburst. Unlike the eclipse, this phenomenon can be observed from anywhere on Earth without using any special equipment. A nova only occurs in binary star systems, consisting of a dying star, typically a large red giant, and a dead star, also known as a white dwarf. Since the two stars orbit in sync, material shed by the red giant accumulates on the surface of the white dwarf. Eventually, the gathered material explodes in a burst of energy known as a nova. It results in a sudden and dramatic increase in brightness, illuminating the night skies. Usually, these events only can be seen through a powerful telescope, but the upcoming T. Coronae, Borealis nova eruption will be visible with the unaided eye. T. Coronae Borealis, or TCRB, is a binary star system located 3,000 light years away from Earth. It is well known for its periodic nova outbursts. They occur approximately once every 80 years. The last one was in 1946. The occurring outbursts stem from tight orbits of the system's red giant and white dwarf star. As the red giant heats up, it sheds its outer layers onto the surface of the white dwarf. This in turn causes the white dwarf's atmosphere to heat up and eventually erupt. The explosion is bright enough to be seen from Earth. Remarkably, white dwarf survives the nova event only to experience it again in the future. Let's see, who is this? Bradley Schaefer. He's an astrophysicist at Louisiana State University. He says, as matter accumulates on the surface of the white dwarf, it heats up, and you get higher and higher pressure until bang! It's a runaway reaction. When will the explosion occur? Well, NASA expects the nova explosion to occur sometime before September of 2024, but its exact timing is hard to determine. Says Schaefer, it could maybe even happen tonight. More probably, it will be within the next couple of months and very probably before the end of the summer. However, everyone will get a chance to see the rare phenomenon. That's because, unlike the eclipse, the nova outburst will be visible to the unaided eye for several days and just over a week with binoculars. It will look like a bright star in the northern sky. Next article here. On Bigler's World, sticking with Dogo news, natural disaster expertise helped limit earthquake death toll. There it is in Taiwan. Marcella Bonet wrote this article. On April 3rd of 2024, a 7.4 magnitude earthquake struck Taiwan's east coast. The tremor centered 11 miles south of the coastal city of, you can pronounce this, Hualien, was the most powerful to hit the island nation in 25 years. It was felt across the country and as far away as Hong Kong and Shanghai, China. The quake sent boulders and mud tumbling down mountains and destroyed or damaged several buildings in Hualien. At least 13 people were killed and over 1,000 were injured. As of April 7th, 2024, rescuers were still looking for six people believed to be buried in the rubble. Let's see, who is this? Taipei resident Hasin Hsong Kang said, I've grown accustomed to earthquakes, but today was the first time I was scared to tears by an earthquake. I was awakened by the earthquake. I had never felt such intense shaking before. The death and injury toll were not trivial. However, they were very low, in comparison to the aftermath of the 7.7 magnitude earthquake that shook Taiwan in 1999. The powerful tremor killed 2,400, injured over 11,000, and destroyed thousands of buildings. The sharp reduction in fatalities is credited to the preemptive measures put in place since 1999. These include sensors that monitor seismic movements and send phone alerts to at-risk residents. The few precious minutes of advance notice most likely saved hundreds of lives on April 3rd. Additionally, officials hold annual earthquake drills to help residents know precisely what to do when an earthquake strikes. Taiwan's strict building codes were another factor in the low fatality rate. The structures shook during the quake and the subsequent aftershocks. However, even the buildings with the most damage stood standing, allowing residents to escape unscathed. Officials state that the majority of the fatalities were the result of landslides near the mountains. Only one person died in a damaged residential building. In fact, within days of the quake, life in Hualien returned to almost normal, with many companies reopening for business. And let's see, there, I got a quote from Stephen Gao. He's a seismologist and a professor at Missouri University of Science and Technology. And he said, "Taiwan's earthquake preparedness is among the most advanced in the world. The island has implemented strict building codes, a world-class seismological network, and widespread public education campaigns on earthquake safety." Earthquakes are relatively common in Taiwan due to its location along the Ring of Fire. The 24,854-mile horseshoe-shaped area on the edge of the Pacific Plate is the biggest and most active of the nine tectonic plates that cover the Earth's surface. Over 90% of the world's earthquakes and 75% of volcano eruptions occur along its path. And the next article here, once again sticking with Dogo News for Kids. National Zoo celebrates the birth of two pygmy slow lorises. Not the fast lorises that we're all used to. Alvaro Aragon wrote this article. The Smithsonian's National Zoo and Conservation Biology Institute, or the NZCBI, in Washington, is celebrating the birth of two adorable pygmy slow lorises. This is the first time the endangered primates have been born at the zoo. The twins are the first offspring of 3-year-old Naga and 2-year-old Pabu. Naga and Pabu arrived at the NZCBI from different zoos back in August of 2022. After carefully examining their health and observing their personalities, the zoo's researchers declared the couple a perfect match and introduced them in September of 2023. As it turns out, they were right. The zoo's small mammal house keepers, they found out about the birth the morning of March 21st, 2024, when they spotted the infants clinging to Naga. They believe the babies were born overnight. Since then, the keepers have observed the new mother lovingly carrying, grooming, and nursing her babies. Pabu has also proved to be a patient and attentive father. He is often seen looking after the twins when Naga goes in search of food. The keepers say the infants, who are weighed daily, are extremely healthy. They are also very alert and already curious about their surroundings. The twins will be named once their gender is determined in a few months. Let's see, who is this? Ingram, one of the small mammal housekeepers, says, "The babies make a very cool clicking vocalization and like to stick their heads out of the nest and check out everything around them." As their name indicates, pygmy slow lorises are tiny. They measure just between 6 and 10 inches. They are adorable. Okay. Though adorable, there it is. They're the only known primates to produce venom. Yikes. The toxin is made in the glands in their upper arms. It is largely used to repel predators and warn other members of their species to avoid their territory. While not lethal to humans, the animal's toxic bite can cause intense pain, and some people it can even result in severe allergic reaction. Pygmy slow lorises are endemic to the rainforests of South and Southeast Asia. The nocturnal animals spend most of their lives 10 to 40 feet up in the forest canopy. The omnivores eat fruits and insects, but about 50 to 70% of their diet is tree sap. This makes them hard to care for in captivity. Once found in abundance, their numbers have been significantly reduced to the destruction of their natural habitats. The primates' adorable looks also make them a huge target for illegal pet trade. The NZCBI hopes the newborns will bring attention to the plight of these endangered animals. Let's see, who is this? Ingram says, every birth helps to keep a sustainable and healthy population of lorises under human care. When guests come to the small mammal house and see the lorises, they have the opportunity to learn about this unique and venomous primate and also to understand the threats they face in the wild and what they can do to help. Okay, next article. I should have read this earlier last week, I guess. But it's about Earth Day, even though that's happened already. Earth Day 2024 highlights the perils of plastic pollution. Cavadolazia wrote this article here. Celebrated every April 22nd, Earth Day is an annual reminder of the urgent need to protect our planet. The global movement began April 22, 1970, when U.S. lawmaker Gaylord Nelson mobilized more than 20 million people to demonstrate support for environmental protection. Earth Day Network, or EDN, now boasts more than 50,000 partners in over 190 countries. It has led to the passage of landmark environmental laws. These include the Clean Water Act of 1972 and the Endangered Species Act of 1973 in the U.S. and the 2015 Paris Agreement, an international treaty on climate change. The theme for Earth Day 2024 is Planet versus Plastics. It highlights the fact that over 380 million tons of plastic are produced annually, an astounding 50% of which is single-use purposes. The nonprofit is demanding a 60% reduction in the production of plastics by the year 2040. EDN has outlined four ways to achieve this lofty goal. The first is to raise public awareness of the health risks of plastic pollution. It has been linked to everything from cancer in humans to death in marine wildlife. The second entails persuading countries worldwide to commit to phasing out all single-use plastics by 2030. EDN also aims to urge governments to implement policies to end fast fashion, another major contributor to plastic pollution. Lastly, they want corporations to invest in innovative technologies to create sustainable materials to substitute plastic. See, who is this? They got a guy here. Kathleen Rogers is not a guy. President of EarthDay.org says, our reliance on plastics could be the biggest gamble in the story of human health history. We are all ingesting and inhaling microplastics. They are everywhere. Are we just hoping that they are safe, or is even the most remote possibility they might be toxic so terrifying that we can't contemplate it? Even if the governments agree, the laws on plastic regulation will take some time to go into effect. Meanwhile, companies can take immediate action to reduce their plastic footprint with minor changes. For example, clothing manufacturers can choose natural or recycled fabrics. Restaurants can deliver food in compostable paper containers. Individuals of all ages can also make a big difference. Avoid single-use plastic spoons and forks by keeping a reusable cutlery set in your backpack or car. Carry a container for leftovers when you go to a restaurant. Take a reusable water bottle and lunch bag to school. These simple actions will go a long way toward saving our planet. And it says, Happy Earth Day. Happy belated Earth Day. Okay, let's do one more article. From Dogo News here on Bigler's World. Cole Brower, I think is how you pronounce that last name, is the first American woman to sail solo around the world non-stop. Marcella Bonet wrote this article as well. Cole Brower, has made history as the first American woman to sail alone around the world without stopping. The Long Island, New York resident completed the tough 30,000-mile global solo challenge on March 7th in just 130 days. Brower placed second among 16 sailors and was one of only seven participants who made it to the finish line. The 29-year-old was the only woman and youngest racer, standing 5 feet 2 inches tall and weighing just 100 pounds. She was also the smallest and lightest competitor. Brower joins an elite group of fewer than 200 sailors who have accomplished this feat. Brower's journey aboard her 40-foot racing vessel, First Light, began from A Coruña, Spain, October 29, 2023. She sailed down the west coast of Africa, then over to Australia, and then around the southern tip of South America before returning to Spain. Throughout the race, Brower's team guided her via satellite. She could also talk to her family members, watch Netflix, and share her daily adventures on Instagram. Though Brower made it look easy, the global solo challenge is not for the faint of heart. Sailors must navigate the three great capes, Africa's Cape of Good Hope, Australia's Cape Leeuwin, and South America's Cape Horn. In particular, sailing around Cape Horn has often been likened to climbing Mount Everest because of its difficulty. Located where the Pacific Ocean meets the Atlantic, it boasts a variety of hazards, including a sharp rise in the ocean floor and strong westerly winds that create massive waves. Brower certainly faced her fair share of difficulties. In one instance, a 30-foot waves, plural, threw her across the boat, injuring her rib badly. In another, she had to insert an IV into her arm due to dehydration caused by nausea and vomiting. Brower fell in love with sailing when she went to college in Hawaii. She originally intended to become a doctor, but instead opted for professional sailing. However, breaking into the largely male-dominated profession has not been easy. Despite her success, she still has a hard time getting sponsors. But the challenges have not deterred the 29-year-old, who is already preparing for her next adventure. Brower hopes her success will inspire other young girls to consider professional sailing. And she says, "It would be amazing if there was just one other girl that saw me and said, 'Oh, I can do that too,'" she said. Okay, let's go to another publication here on Bigler's World, right here. Let's see, let's go to Frontiers for Young Minds. TikTok, it's time for bed, says Nicholas John Castarinteco. And the article starts like this: the sleep-wake cycle is critical for health. Sleep is a part of the body's natural 24-hour clock, which is called the circadian rhythm. The circadian rhythm regulates the body's sleep-wake cycle, by using information from the environment to help our bodies wake up in the morning and go to sleep at night. The cycle depends on messenger chemicals called hormones produced in the body, and it is a delicate balance. When it is in proper balance, the circadian rhythm allows us to stay awake and alert during the day, and when we have enough energy to complete our tasks. A balanced circadian rhythm also allows us to go to sleep on time at night, recover from tiredness, eliminate cellular waste products that have built up, and repair any minor damage to our muscles that we have developed during our daytime activities, making us feel refreshed and ready to go again in the morning. We depend on light in the morning and darkness at night to help the body's clock continue turning on cycle, regulating the body's processes. When it gets dark outside, the absence of light sends a signal to the brain that it is time to start the sleep cycle part of the 24-hour clock. The brain interprets darkness as a message saying there is no need to stay awake and alert. And a pea-sized gland in the brain called the pineal gland begins to release a hormone called melatonin into the bloodstream. Melatonin is essential for the sleep-wake cycle. It helps promote good health, a good quality sleep, so that you and your body recovers and feels rested in the morning. The sleep cycle has four stages, N1, N2, N3, and rapid eye movement, REM. All stages are important. During N1 through 3, growth occurs. The muscles and the immune system are repaired, and the body and mind recover from tiredness. In the REM stage, the brain is highly active, just like when we are awake, and this stage is important for memory development, learning, and dreaming, as well as for decreasing the level of a type of cellular waste product called free radicals. When free radicals are present in high concentrations, they can damage both the body and brain cells. For healthy, restful sleep, we must go through several sleep cycles each night. Interruption or a decrease in the number of complete cycles can lead to poor quality sleep, leading to poor cognitive performance, decreased recovery, and incomplete free radical elimination. Repeated interruptions or decreased time sleeping can lead to a condition called oxidative stress, in which the level of free radicals gets dangerously high. This happens because bodily processes that normally slow down while we sleep keep running instead, like a car that never shuts off and keeps producing exhaust. Elevated levels of these free radicals can decrease health and cognitive performance. Interesting, melatonin can help to neutralize excess free radicals in the body, so it is believed to have a strong protective effect against oxidative stress. How do light and darkness regulate the sleep-wake cycle? All pathways that control essential functions in the body exist in balance with each other, with other pathways that produce the opposite effects. This way, pathways can regulate each other. This is the case with hormones melatonin and cortisol. Cortisol is a stress hormone released by the adrenal glands, which sit atop the kidneys, and it is responsible for creating the state of being awake and alert. In the morning, as the light from the sun enters our eyes, a signal is sent to the brain that acts like a wake-up alarm. The release of melatonin stops, and the level of cortisol in the bloodstream rises, causing us to feel awake and alert. This process aligns the body's clock to the time of day. However, the same wake-up alarm effect happens when we use technology at night. The light from electronic devices enters our eyes, sending a signal to the brain that it should still be awake, alert, and on duty. One type of light produced by most devices, called blue light, is especially good at preventing melatonin release. The sun emits more blue light in the morning as it rises than at night when it sets, so our bodies are designed to respond to blue light by waking up. By preventing melatonin from being released when it should be, the brain is tricked into thinking it's still daytime even though it's dark outside. Therefore, we do not fall asleep when we should, a condition called sleep latency, because the brain is receiving the message that it should be awake, alert, and functioning. Sleep latency puts the circadian rhythm off balance, which can lead to a number of problems. Tech at night affects mental health. Just like our battery-powered devices, our bodies need to recharge to function at their highest capacity. If our body's batteries run down and we do not stop to recharge, our bodies will not run as efficiently nor function at their best. Furthermore, the bodily systems for regulating mood depend on sleep. When sleep latency happens, other pathways that regulate cortisol levels will also be affected. In this case, people can develop mood disorders related to elevated cortisol, including depression and other mental illnesses. Scientists have discovered that people who work night shift jobs are 40% more likely to develop depression, probably due to the interruption of the circadian rhythm and general lack of sleep. Protecting yourself from sleep problems. Even if you currently use your devices at night and experience the negative effects lack of sleep can have, there are ways to reverse the effects and fix any imbalance in your circadian rhythm. While scientists have found that depriving rats of REM sleep for 96 hours, there it is, increases free radicals and oxidative stress in the rats' brains, these effects were reversed after the rats had some restorative sleep. This means that even if you feel unwell after a few nights of poor sleep, you can restore your circadian rhythm, reduce your levels of free radicals and oxidative stress, and get yourself back to functioning normally simply by getting some good quality sleep. Furthermore, limiting or completely eliminating the use of electronic devices before bedtime can prevent interruption of the circadian rhythm, which will prevent sleep latency and help the natural sleep cycle. Sleep-wake cycle. Switching the lights in your home to the lower amount of blue light you encounter leading up to bedtime can help too. Red light has been shown to improve sleep quality, and yellow and orange lights have little to no effect on circadian rhythm and may increase melatonin production. Finally, if you must use technology at night, using a pair of blue light blocking glasses and turning on your nighttime mode in the evening can help to decrease the amount of blue light your device gives off. This will limit the signals to your brain that prevent melatonin release and cause sleep latency, which can help you get a better night's sleep. Overall, sleep is one of the most important contributors to our mental and physical health and cognitive functioning. Taking care to place our devices aside about an hour before bedtime makes a world of difference in the sleep quality we have each night, as well as our overall physical and mental health. As a result, our circadian rhythm will be in balance and we will be able to fall asleep and wake up around the same times every day. Through making these efforts, we can ensure we get regular, good quality, and uninterrupted sleep to stay healthy and productive. Okay, let's go to, what is this, CDC? I'm reading CDC Kid News. It's Kid News. The countdown to the 2024 Paris Olympics has started. Bum, 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 bum. Let's see, athletes from around the world will come together in Paris, France to kick off the 2024 Olympic Games. From July 26th to August 11th, they will compete for gold in traditional sports like running and long jump and newer sports like surfing and skateboarding. Then from August 28th to September 8th, athletes with physical disabilities will compete in a parallel event called the 2024 Paralympic Games. While summer may still seem far away, both the Olympics and Paralympics are already making news. Oh, yes. The lighting of the torch. On April 16th, an actor dressed as an ancient Greek priestess lit a torch on the site of the original games in Olympia, Greece. Over the next 11 days, a relay of torchbearers will carry the flame through the countryside to Greece's capital city, Athens. After that, the flame will travel all the way to Marseille, France, on a boat. Let's see, where does the article continue here? Paris police clear out the homeless. Right there. Meanwhile, in Paris, police cleared out a makeshift camp for the homeless at an abandoned building in the outskirts of the city on April 17th. Local authorities have been getting rid of these camps as the city prepares to host the Olympics and Paralympics. The camp was home to about 450 people, including kids. Most of them were migrants and had moved to France from other countries. Aid workers expressed concern that the officials were moving the homeless without helping them find longer-term housing. And next article here on Bigler's World. Stick with the CBC News for kids. Three people rescued after a week stranded on a remote Pacific island. And it says here, not the first time people have been rescued from this island. You've probably seen it happen in cartoons. A group of people wind up stranded on a remote island and write SOS or help in the sand with hopes that a plane will spot them and come to their rescue. Turns out the strategy actually works. See, this was a couple of weeks ago. Yeah, this week, it says here, the U.S. Navy aircraft, they were searching for three missing men in the southern Pacific Ocean. They spotted palm branches that spelled help on the beach. The men were found on Pikelot Island, a small, uninhabited island. It's about 670 kilometers, whatever that is, southeast of Guam. The men were reportedly missing 6 days after embarking on a voyage from Poluwat, a small island in Micronesia. A family member notified authorities that the Coast Guard and Navy began a search and rescue operation. Rescuers said the help sign was essential to spotting them. They got a picture of it here. And so U.S. Coast Guard Lieutenant Chelsea Garcia said in a statement, "This act of ingenuity was pivotal in guiding rescue efforts directing to their location." During their week stranded on the island, the men had access to food and water and made shelter to survive. And it's not the first time people have been rescued from the island. According to the New York Times, three sailors were found about 4 years ago after writing SOS in the sand. Okay, let us go to another publication here. Let's do some science. Science News Explorers. This article entitled, "Among Mammals, Males Aren't Usually Bigger Than Females." That is crazy stuff. Biologists long assumed females were typically smaller. That's not true, new data suggests. And Jonathan Lambert, writes about it. Scientists have long thought that when it comes to mammals, males tend to be larger than females. They may not be that might not be true after all, it appears. A new study looked at hundreds of mammal species. In just over half, females are as big or bigger than the males. The idea that male mammals are bigger than females has, says Kia Tombeck, just been this assumption. Most people just went along with it. Without good evidence, she says. An evolutionary biologist, Tom Back works at Purdue University. That's in West Lafayette, Indiana. It's well known that males and females of the same species can differ in size. This is known as sexual size dimorphism. To understand why these differences arise, biologists have often looked at big, flashy mammals. Think lions or gorillas. These species often do have larger males, but focusing on them ignores lots of other species. What's more, some past studies don't report how animal size can vary within a species, Tombeck notes. That makes it hard to tell for sure whether the males of a species really are, on average, bigger than the females. We tried to get at this question by being a bit more rigorous, she says. Tombeck was part of a team that looked at data on the weights of males and females in 429 mammal species. In 45 of them, males tended to be heavier than females. In 16% of species, females were heavier. In 39%, males and females were about the same size. The team found similar trends when they looked at data on how long animals were. Well-studied groups think carnivores, primates, and hooved animals tend to have heavier males, but nearly half of bats and have heavier females, and about half of rodents, males and females, weighed about the same. One limit of this study, it looked at only about 5% of all mammal species. But these did come from across the mammal family tree, Tombeck says, so she's confident the team got the overall picture of differences in mammal size right. Past studies have shown that larger female animals are quite common, but who is this? Malin Åking, an evolutionary biologist at Stockholm University in Sweden. She didn't take part in the study, but she said this. But the research has been male-centered. The evolution of females often has been overlooked, Åking says. As a result, the notion that male mammals tend to be bigger has just become accepted. That supposed size difference has shaped scientists' ideas about how mammals mate. Often the story goes, bigger bodies give the males an edge in battle, and that helps them get the attention of smaller female mates. The new findings that many species do not actually have larger males complicates that story. Kathleen Shepherd, she's an evolutionary biologist at the University of Aberdeen in Scotland, she says,
the real power of this study is that they were very careful and methodical. Oh, yes.
The results show that there are things that people just blithely assume
because they haven't thought about it. They just didn't think.
That deeply, she says. Ditching those assumptions can free biologists to ask new questions, Sherrod says. For instance, why are females bigger in some species? Or what forces keep males and females in other species the same size? The new study, Sherrod says,
has opened up a clearer understanding of what's going on in the natural world.
Got all Scottish tongue-tied there. Let's do another article from Science News Explorers. This egg-laying amphibian, got that one backwards, feeds its babies milk. That's right, it's an egg-laying amphibian. Like mammals, these legless, burrowing animals make a nutrient-rich fluid for their young, says Jake Bueller. In a humid coastal rainforest, a litter of pink, hairless babies snuggle with their mom. They stir and squeak for milk and drink from their mother until they are full. But these are no puppies or cubs. No, they are snake-shaped amphibians, far closer to frogs than foxes. Mammals are named for their ability to produce milk, but scientists have found that a few species that are not mammals feed their young this way too. These include certain spiders, fishes, cockroaches, and birds, and now snake-shaped amphibians. Chelonians? They are the first amphibians known to feed hatchlings a kind of milk. They got a pronunciation here. Caecilians. That's how you pronounce it. Caecilians. They have many strange features, rarely seen. They are burrowing creatures that are nearly blind. Some species, like the ringed Caecilian, have poisonous slime and may be venomous. They feed their own skin to their young. Well, that's my childhood. Herpetologist Carlos Jared of the Instituto Butantan in São Paulo, Brazil, has been studying these animals for years. After hatching ringed Caecilians babies, they live with their mothers for 2 months. Jared and his research team found that the babies spent much more of their time around the end of their mom's body. That's where there's an opening called a vent. It is shared by mom's reproductive, digestive, and urinary systems. All in one place. Jared's team saw the female would expel a thick fluid from her vent. Her young would then enthusiastically feed on it. Jared notes, some young even stuck their heads inside the opening. This is a pretty gross article. Caring for their young. For the new study, the team worked in the Bahia state of Brazil. They collected 16 females and their babies, then they observed them in the lab. In all, they videoed these mothers and babies for more than 240 hours. Feedings started with the babies wriggling and nibbling at their mother's vent. They also made high-pitched noises. Ma would then raise that end of her body and release the fluid. This happened up to 6 times per day. It looked like the mothers were responding to the baby's pleas. The squeaking and begging is a fascinating observation, says Mark Wilkinson. He's an evolutionary biologist in England at the London Natural History Museum. Adult ring Caecilians are thought to be sensitive only to lower-pitched sounds, he says. So it's surprising that mom seems to respond to high-pitched noises from their young. The researchers examined the internal anatomy, there it is, of some of the adult females. They also analyzed the fluid. It is secreted by glands in the tube through which the eggs travel from the ovary. It is known as the oviduct. The glands enlarge while the female's raising her hatchlings. This milk, in quotation marks, is rich in fats, such as mammal milk is. This nutritious resource may help explain how the hatchlings grow so fast. They more than double their mass in the first week of life. Their only other nourishment is their mother's skin, which they feed on once every few days. This is a science fiction movie. Isabella Capellini, she wonders if the squiggling siblings compete for milk access. She studies evolution at Queen's University in Belfast, Northern Ireland. Capellini is also curious about how the milk production affects the mother. Is this her talking? Yes, it is. She says, in mammals, lactation is the most expensive stage of reproduction for the mother. That is that it requires lots of energy from food or her stored fat. It would be useful to study whether milk production is expensive in Caecilians too, says Capellini. How is the mother impacted in the short and long term? It is not known how these amphibians evolve their version of milk, but a clue may come from other Caecilian species that give birth to live young. Their oviducts sometimes feed their babies a milky substance while in the womb. These species, however, do not feed their babies after they are born. Perhaps live-bearing Caecilians, Wilkinson says, could have evolved from egg-laying species that already used their oviducts to produce food. That's Wilkinson talking there. We really have learned a lot about Caecilians in the last few decades, but we are only seeing the tip of the iceberg. That was a creepy article. And I read it creepy, too. I'm kind of proud of that. Let's do another one. Now, this one isn't going to be quite as creepy, I don't think. Sticking with Science News Explorers, let's learn about fingerprints. Shall we? Scientists are still learning how these unique patterns on our fingertips form and how to use them to solve crimes. Because apparently that's all they're good for. Maria Temming wrote this article. Nearly everyone in the world carries a unique ID right at their fingertips. These are their fingerprints, the swooping, swirling patterns in the fine ridges of skin on the pads of their fingers. No two people have the same fingerprints, not even identical twins. That's why some phones can be unlocked using a user's fingertip, and why fingerprints left at a crime scene can help identify who done it. That's all one word. Fingerprints form before birth. The patterns originate from three spots on each fingertip, under the nail, at the center of the finger pad, and at the crease of the first finger joint. The design of a fingerprint depends on how skin ridges spread out from these three spots and merge. A person's fingerprints may spread out slightly over the course of their life, but the overall pattern stays the same. When someone touches an object, they may leave a stamp of their fingerprint on it. This imprint may be made of oil, dirt, or other substances that were on the person's skin. Forensic scientists have long gathered such fingerprints from crime scenes. Those prints can offer clues about who has been at a certain place and what they did there. Fingerprints have not always allowed investigators to find the right culprit. Criminals have wiped their fingerprints off objects at crime scenes to cover their tracks. What's more, it's been hard to tell whether fingerprints found at a crime scene were left by the criminal or someone else at another time. But new research is helping to make fingerprints more reliable evidence. One team has found a way to uncover fingerprints that have been wiped down. The technique relies on the fact that chemicals in a person's fingerprint corrode metal surfaces. That corrosion can be detected even if the print is not visible. Other scientists have found a way to estimate the age of a fingerprint. They do this by looking at chemicals in fingerprints that change over time as they interact with air. This can expose whether the fingerprint dates to the time of the crime or before or after. Okay, let's go to yet another publication here on Bigler's World.
Is Bigler's World.
Let's do a little National Geographic Kids magazine, why don't we? They got a thing on the Statue of Liberty, written by Peter Winkler. On July 4th, 1884, France presented the United States with an incredible birthday gift, the Statue of Liberty. Without its pedestal, it's as tall as a 15-story building. She represents the United States, but the world-famous Statue of Liberty standing in New York Harbor was built in France. France. The statue was presented to the U.S., taken apart, shipped across the Atlantic Ocean in crates, and rebuilt in the U.S. It was France's gift to the American people. There you go. It all started at dinner one night near Paris in 1865. A group of Frenchmen were discussing their dictator-like emperor and the democratic government of the United States. They decided to build a monument to American freedom and perhaps even strengthen French demands for democracy in their own country. At that dinner was the sculptor Frédéric Auguste Bartholdi. He imagined a statue of a woman holding a torch burning with the light of freedom. Turning Bartholdi's idea into reality took 21 years. French supporters raised money to build the statue, and Americans paid for the pedestal it would stand on. Finally, in 1886, the statue was dedicated. Here's some fast facts. The statue sways 3 inches in the wind. The torch sways 5 inches. Visitors climb 354 steps to look out from 25 windows in the crown. The statue, 151 feet 1 inches tall, was the tallest structure in the U.S. at the time. Engineer Gustav Eiffel, who would later design the Eiffel Tower in Paris, designed Liberty's spine. Inside the statue, 4 huge iron columns support a metal framework that holds the thin copper skin. Frédéric Auguste Bartholdi, he knew he wanted to build a giant copper goddess. He used his mother as the model. The statue was covered in 300 sheets of coin-thin copper. They were hammered into different shapes and riveted together. The arm with the torch measures 46 feet. The finger is 8 feet. The nose nearly 5 feet. And the last one they got here, 7 rays in the crown represent the Earth's 7 seas.
That's crazy. I did not know that.
The New Colossus, a poem written by Emma Lazarus in 1883, is on display on the statue's pedestal. And they got it right here. The poem is right here. The New Colossus starts like this and finishes later on. Not like a brazen giant of Greek fame with conquering limbs astride from land to land, here at our sea-washed sunset gates shall stand a mighty woman with a torch whose flame is imprisoned lightning, and her name, Mother of Exiles. From her beacon hand glows worldwide welcome, her mild eyes command the air-bridged harbor that Twin Cities fame. Keep ancient lands your storied pomp, she cries with silent lips. Give me your tired, your poor, your huddled masses yearning to breathe free, the wretched refuse of your teeming shore. Send these, the homeless, tempest-tossed to me. I lift my lamp beside the golden door. That's the end of it. End of the article. In the next article, we'll just stick with the whole France thing. Sticking with National Geographic Kids as well. France is the largest country in Western Europe, has long been a gateway between the continent's northern and southern regions. Here's some fast facts. Fast facts. Official name, French Republic. Form of government, it's a republic. Capital right there in Paris. Population, 67,364,357. The official language is France, or just French. Their money, they still use the euro there. How big is it? It is 210,026 square miles. Major mountain ranges, the Alps, the Pyrenees, and the Massif Central. Major rivers, the Seine, the Rhine, and the Rhone. All together. Let's do some geography on France, shall we? France, the largest country in Western Europe, has been the gateway. Its lengthy borders touch Germany and Belgium in the north, the Atlantic Ocean in the west, the Pyrenees Mountains, and Spain in the south. Wide, fertile plains dominate most of the north and west, making France the agricultural epicenter. The sprawling forested plateau of the Massif Central, a range of ancient mountains and extinct volcanoes, occupies France's southern interior. Let's see, they got a picture of the Eiffel Tower here. People and culture. France is one of the oldest nations on Earth and the most ethnically diverse country in Europe. These deep and broad influences have made France a world leader throughout history in nearly all aspects of culture, including cuisine, winemaking, politics, philosophy, music, art, film, fashion, literature, and sports. Let's see, they got a picture of the French flag. It's blue, white, and red. They got it backwards. It's supposed to be red, white, and blue. I don't get it. Let's go to nature. France has ample land area to provide habitat for a wide variety of plants and animals. More than 25% of its territory is covered with forest, and another 50% is countryside or farmland. Lowland forests are home to deer and wild boar, while the woodlands of the Alps and Pyrenees provide refuge for rare chamois antelopes. That's where we get the chamois from. And the ibex, you got brown bears and alpine hares, among many other species. The Mediterranean coastline is a stopover of millions of migrating African birds, including flamingos, vultures, egrets, and bee eaters. The French government has made a broad commitment to preserving open spaces and wildlife that they contain. About 10% of the country has been set aside as national or regional parklands and nature reserves. Okay, let's go over to Scholastic Kids Press. Read an article or two there, I guess. Waka T. Brown talks about writing for children. Who wrote this? Owen Marksbury. And it goes like this. Waka T. Brown has published 3 novels for middle graders. Her latest book, The Very Unfortunate Wish of Melanie Yoshimura, came out last summer. I recently spoke with Brown near her home in the Portland, Oregon area. We discussed her books and her love of writing. The main character of Brown's latest novel, Melanie Yoshimura, is a middle schooler who wants more freedom from her overprotective parents. The story's villain, an evil spirit called Amenjaku, gets her everything she wants, but Melanie soon learns that trusting the Amenjaku has a terrible price. Brown, who is of Japanese ancestry, is the first member of her family to be born in the United States. She grew up in Topeka, Kansas. Her latest novel, she said, was inspired by a Japanese folktale, The Melon Princess and the Amenjaku. She says, the folktale was one of my favorite children's books. During the pandemic, she saw parallels between Amenjaku's story and people's experiences in lockdown. Everybody around me wanted a lot more freedom, she says. Parents also had this fear of letting their kids do too much. Brown hopes that young readers will think more deeply about their actions as they grow up and gain their independence. That freedom comes with a certain amount of responsibility, she said. Becoming a writer, Brown didn't start writing seriously until her senior year at Stanford University. She wrote screenplays and began writing for middle graders. Her debut novel, While I Was Away, was published in 2021. Her second novel, Dream Annie Dream, came out in 2022. Both titles are published by Quill Tree Press. While I Was Away recounts Brown's move to Japan when she was 12. Her parents sent her to live with her grandmother because they feared she was losing her Japanese language skills in the U.S. Dream Annie Dream is a fictional novel based on Brown's experiences growing up in Kansas in the 1980s. Brown's next title, a picture book called Perfect, will be published in the fall. She also has another novel coming out in winter. In addition to writing, Brown enjoys running, baking, and playing the guitar. She and her husband have three sons. Brown's advice for aspiring writers is to not get discouraged. Remember that you like writing, she said. Whether or not it sells or it's published or not published, just the act of writing is wonderful. You're creating something. Next article, sticking with Scholastic Kids Press. It's the Kid Reporter's Notebook. Bindi Irwin offers advice for Earth Day, which we had, was that last week? It was yesterday. Evie Bingle wrote this article here. Is this her talking, Bindi? I think she talks like this. For me, conservation work isn't just a job. It's a part of who I am, says Bindi Irwin. The 25-year-old is a conservationist, zookeeper, public speaker, and actress. She was named after her favorite crocodile of her late father Steve's at Australia's Zoo, home of Crocodile Hunter, which is owned by the Irwin family. Earth Day, yesterday, April 22nd this year, so I thought it would be a good time to get tips about helping the environment from Bindi, whose family is known worldwide for their conservation efforts. She answered my questions via email from Birrawa, a small town on the Sunshine Coast in Queensland, where the zoo is located. Earth Day was first celebrated in 1970. Since then, it's become the largest civic event on Earth, according to organizers. Over the years, the annual event has mobilized 1 billion people for the future of our planet, Mr. Beale. Protecting animals, the first section they got here, for Bindi and other conservationists, every day is Earth Day. And I guess it's there. Yep, Bindi explaining, from the moment I can remember, my parents have involved me in their conservation work every chance they got. Growing up, all I wanted to be part of their work and wildlife in wild places. I wanted to be just like my parents, protecting animals and making a positive difference in the world. Along with her mother, Terry, and her brother, Robert, Bindi carries on the work begun by her father, one of the most famous and beloved conservationists on the planet. He was tragically killed in 2006 by a stingray while filming in the Great Barrier Reef, which is located off the coast of Queensland. Before that, Steve and Terry hosted a popular wildlife TV series called The Crocodile Hunter. She says, I feel so lucky to have traveled around the world with my family on many, many different conservation missions, Bindi told me. It opened my eyes to understand that it's all up to us to do our part in caring for the planet. Although the Irwin family is known for preserving wildlife, Bindi explained that such efforts benefit people, too.
Conservation isn't just about woodland creatures, she wrote. Ultimately, it's about us as humans. We are connected and reliant on our natural world for our own survival. Believe in your strength. Bindi is familiar to many TV viewers because of shows like Crikey, It's the Irwins, Bindi, the Jungle Girl, and even Dancing with the Stars. On stage or at the zoo, Bindi encourages kids to make a positive difference in the environment. Believe in your strengths to change the world, she tells them. You can undertake and accomplish anything you put your mind to. Your kind actions, even the small ones, can create waves of positive change. And let's do one more article here in Scholastic Kids Press. So what do we got here? A Georgia leader offers advice. Sky Oduren wrote this particular article. Let's see, who is this? Georgia Butler, Democratic minority leader of the Georgia State Senate, says, I did not come in with the idea of being our leader. She simply wanted, she said, to make a difference in our caucus. A caucus is a group of representatives from a political party that work together to achieve common goals. I spoke with Butler on March 28, the final day of the State Senate's legislative session. The lawmakers convene annually at the Georgia State Capitol in Atlanta. This year, they discuss bills related to education, including students' access to books, election guidelines, immigration, and other issues. Butler represents the 55th district, which includes part of Atlanta and the surrounding areas. She is the first woman and first African American to serve as minority leader of the Georgia State Senate. Her involvement in the legislative body began in 1999 when she was sworn in as a state senator. She was elected Democratic minority leader in 2021. Butler worked hard to win her leadership role. As I came into the Senate, I wanted us to be the best that we could be, she said. I volunteered in our caucus to do certain roles. Butler knew little about fundraising, but she saw a need for leadership. There was no one in our caucus who was raising money, so I took that role, Butler said. Despite her relative inexperience, she succeeded. I raised more money for the caucus than anyone else, she told me. During her time in the Republican-controlled state Senate, Butler has served respectively as minority whip, chair, and minority leader. A whip keeps track of the party's votes on upcoming legislation and works with members to maintain unity. Butler has also served on several of the state Senate's committees, including Ethics, Health and Human Services, and Public Safety. Focus on the people. Butler, who is 82, plans to retire at the end of the year. She hopes that others will continue the work she has begun. On the last day of their legislative session, there it is, Butler addressed her fellow state senators. We have the power to make this state a better place, she said. We work together to fix problems. With that, I'm out of time. This is Bigler for Bigler's World. I will read with you next week. Until then, bye-bye, everybody. Bye-bye.